You might have noticed we don't always put a lot of thought into what we eat. It's just too easy to grab something off a shelf or from the fridge when we get hungry. But does it take that much more effort to eat with some concept of health in mind? Today's guest will likely let us know. Jennifer McGruther is the author of a book on traditional food philosophy containing a bunch of recipes. Nourished Kitchen is a website, and Jennifer McGruther created it. She and her husband started and managed a farmer's market for a number of years, and she teaches workshops on traditional foods, fermentation, and food activism. Jennifer McGruther, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. Good to have you here. What's the general focus of your food activism, then?
I focus primarily on traditional foods and sustainable farming, in essence, protecting the consumer right to access the foods of his or her choice.
And what? Tell us about your farmer's market. What did you do that others did not, or what were you trying to do that you didn't think had been attempted before?
When I live in a community of only about 1,500 people, so it's very, very small. And when my husband and I moved here, we realized that there wasn't access to a large variety of fresh foods, besides local foods. Just we didn't have very much fresh food. So we began a farmer's market here. And what sets our market apart from others in our region is that it's restrictive in that we insist that our farmers coming to the market adhere to sustainable agriculture. They don't have to be certified organic, but they certainly need to practice pasture-based farming and use organic practices. Another difference with our farmers market is that we have a strong sense of community, and that means that we seek out opportunities to serve the community not only through hosting the farmers market, but also through providing avenues for low-income and underprivileged families to access fresh, local, organic foods.
And what are some of the avenues you were able to provide those opportunities?
One of our most popular avenues is our food bank. In the summertime, many of our farmers have an overabundance of fresh produce or eggs or even meat from occasionally. And so what we do is we allow our farmers to pay their market fees in kind. So they are allowed to... for example, say, $30 in market fees, provide $30 worth of tomatoes. This is then shared among volunteers who spend their time setting up the market, breaking it down. And any excess then we funnel through to a food bank that is hosted on Monday evenings. And that food bank focuses exclusively on providing whole, unprocessed, fresh foods to community members.
Do you still run the farmers market, or is that past tense?
I'm still involved as a consultant on the farmers market, but we recently hired a new executive director in the last year who's taking on the burden of managing the market from day to day.
The workshops you teach on traditional foods, when we say traditional foods, what do you mean?
Traditional foods are the foods of your great-great-grandmothers. That's the easiest way to come across the philosophy. They're the techniques that we've kind of lost in the last 100 years as industrial and processed foods have replaced the traditional unprocessed foods that our great-grandparents focused on. And what that means for me is a lot of homemade broths, fermented foods. So, for example, sauerkraut and kefir, kimchi. They are also, traditional foods are also the foods of organic pastures, of sustainable agriculture. So, for example, fresh vegetables, sourdough breads, slow-cooked meats, and that's the essence of what traditional foods are.
Who is Weston Price? He's mentioned in your book, The Nourished Kitchen.
Weston Price is a native of Canada. He practiced dentistry in Cleveland, Ohio, during the early part of the 20th century. And during his practice, he was primarily focused on pediatric care, his small children. And what he noticed over the years is the level of health of the children coming into his practice really degenerated with time. And he found that children, even as young as 2 or 3, were coming into his practice with severely decayed teeth, as well as other health effects. And he considered what that meant in terms of broader health. So he left his practice for a period of time, on and off, and he traveled the world to take a look at the traditional diets of people in isolated areas of the world, all over, including including Africa, isolated pockets of the Alps, the Outer Hebrides, the South Pacific, all across the world. He examined the native diets of people who did not have access to modern foods. And what I mean by modern foods is they did not have access to white flour, white sugar, refined vegetable oils. And he found that even though these people in isolated pockets who had nothing, who could only subsist on their native and traditional foods, they did not have modern healthcare nor modern dentistry, but their health blossomed and bloomed, and they were free from a lot of the conditions that he found in his practice, even though in his modern practice people did have healthcare. And so that helped him to identify the key differences in traditional diets versus the modern diets of his time. And he found that traditional diets and the people who adhered to their traditional diets, which were marked by an absence of processed food, exhibited exemplary health and also consumed a higher amount of fat-soluble vitamins as well as minerals.
All right, I want to get into a little more definition about processed foods and what we lose when they are that heavily processed and what we gain, which might not be the good stuff. When we come back from a break, we're talking to Jennifer McGruther about her book, The Nourished Kitchen, which is like her website in between the covers of a book. It's farm-to-table recipes for the traditional foods lifestyle. More with Jennifer McGruther and your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Happy Friday to you. We are talking today about food, specifically traditional foods, foods that are healthy for you, the foods of your great-great-grandmothers. I think you had two greats in there, Jennifer. Jennifer McGruther is our guest. She is the creator of the website NourishedKitchen.com, which is now in print, in a sense, in the book The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about traditional foods and what is meant by that and how you might be carrying that out in your own life. Join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So we're just talking about processing of foods and how people who live in remote parts of the world where there are not processed foods available, no white flour, no refined sugar, no refined oils, the food is literally coarser, but apparently much better for you as well.
Certainly. It's a rustic food, and it's food that is simple. It's very simple food. It's humble food, and it's food that is easily prepared in the kitchen. We're talking about butter, yogurt, fresh vegetables, stews and broths, fermented vegetables, and of course, nose-to-tail eating, or you know, the cooking of offal, was prominent in all traditional societies.
That's how it's pronounced, offal, O-F-F-A-L?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. I noticed some people like to pronounce it awful, but...
Awful, offal.
Yeah. So we're talking about the parts of the animal that you generally don't eat, but they get boiled up for other stuff, right?
That's correct. And, you know, it's only very recently, in the last 50 to 75 years, that our society has enjoyed the luxury of waste. And that, what I mean by that is, for the longest time, families were farming families. You had a pig that you raised, you had a steer, perhaps, and you were obligated, for hunger's sake, to consume as much of the animal as possible. And that meant that people were consuming liver, they were consuming bones in the form of broth and marrow, they were consuming kidney and other offal that we consider relatively distasteful in modern cooking. And the benefit to these organ meats were that they are highly nutrient-dense. They are extraordinarily rich in nutrients like folate, which is critical for women of reproductive age. They are also extraordinarily rich in minerals like iron and zinc. So we find that they were eating traditional foods are nutrient-dense foods.
And that is the issue then with processing, is we're leaving in the tasty things, it sounds like, but getting rid of a lot of the nutrients in the processing process.
Certainly. So, for example, when we process grain into white flour, and there certainly is a place for white flour from time to time as you feel ready to indulge, of course. But as we remove, as we process our foods, we remove a lot of the vital nutrients that they contain. Certainly with foods like vegetable oil, which is highly processed, and it is high in polyunsaturated fatty acids, which are very, very fragile. And that processing not only strips a lot of these foods from of their natural complement of nutrients, it also can introduce potentially harmful effects as well.
What is it that's taken out of vegetable oil, then, that that removes so much of its nutrition?
Well, a lot of vegetable oil, soybean oil, corn oil, and the like, they're not traditional foods in and of themselves. Olive oil, for example, is a traditional food. Lard is a traditional food. Butter is a traditional food. And so vegetable oils have only been very recently introduced into our diets. So you don't find them, even an unprocessed version featured prominently in any traditional diet. But what happens is when vegetable oils are processed, they're pressed, they're often processed through hexane extraction, chemical solvents, they're bleached, they're deodorized, and this entire process can really fundamentally change what was good about the corn in the first place or about the soybean in the first place.
And I believe there's a section of the book where you do a bit of a riff on olive oil anyway, that a lot of stuff that is on the store shelves is itself a bit overprocessed, even though it is, in fact, olive oil.
That's true. Actually, what we find is that olive oil is one of the most adulterated foods on the market. And so because of the high demand for olive oil, which is a wonderful food, it's got great flavor, it's got a lot of phytonutrients, because of the high demand for olive oil, what we find is that a lot of olive oils are adulterated with vegetable oil, soybean oil, corn oil, canola oil, which are far less expensive than olive oil. And this happens between the time the oil is pressed on the farm or at the pressing site and then sold to a middleman who then sells it to a wholesaler. So olive oil is definitely one of the most adulterated foods on the market, which is why I think one of the prominent themes in my work and certainly in the book and on NourishKitchen.com is the importance of sourcing directly from the grower or the farmer if you have that capability. And there are many opportunities for us to source olive oil, at least in the United States. For example, only about 3% of the olive oil we consume in the U.S. right now is produced in the U.S., and that despite the fact that California has some of the best old-growth olive orchards around. So you can certainly bypass the risk of adulteration by seeking out olive oil producers directly.
In fact, the very southern end of our listening area around Red Bluff and on south is actually an area where there is a fair amount of olive production. And so there should be olive oils available fairly cheaply to people in our region anyway. I want to come back to the term sustainable. You talked about that when you ran a farmer's market for a number of years, you and your husband started this market, that you wanted to make sure that the foods were sustainable. And as you point out yourself in the book, the term sustainable is chucked around rather easily. So when we get into the Nourished Kitchen philosophy, what do you mean by sustainable in your context?
In my context, and yes, we use that term far too lightly, I think, and it doesn't have a strong, defined concept. But in my work, sustainability means that it must be good for the environment, economically sustainable for the farmer, and good for the community as well. And when it comes to farming, that generally means adhering to organic practices, though you may or may not be certified organic.
Even if you are going with sustainability, even if you are making sure that you steer clear of unprocessed foods, getting them direct from the local producer, I mean, this is a cookbook as well. There are lots of recipes in here. I don't want to get into those. But can you still manage to poorly prepare good foods and still manage to knock a lot of the nutrients out of them in the process?
Well, I think that one of the best things that anybody can do is just start off using fresh foods. And then for those who wish to take the concept further, certainly preparation methods can highly influence how nutrient-dense the foods are that you consume. Traditional foods is not only about where we source our foods and what we choose to eat. Traditional foods also emphasizes heavily how you prepare them. And certain techniques can really enhance the bioavailability of nutrients. And these are traditional techniques. For example, sourdough bread, sourdough leavening, increases the content of folate in the grains. Fermenting milk into kefir, which is a traditional yogurt-like beverage out of the Caucasus, also enhances B vitamins. Fermenting cabbage into sauerkraut, you see similarly an increase in B vitamins. Another technique that can be really valuable is soaking your whole grains, sprouting them, or souring them through fermentation or through sourdough leavening. And the reason for that is that grains and seeds and beans and pulses, they all contain a component called food phytate, which is a component found in these foods that can bind up the minerals in these foods and prevent their full absorption. So when you practice traditional methods of preparing them, soaking flour in buttermilk to produce true buttermilk biscuits, soaking beans overnight before you turn them into chili, as well as sprouting grains for sprouted grain bread, you not only enhance the B vitamin content found in these foods, but you also mitigate the effects or deactivate food phytate and thereby increase the availability of minerals found in these foods. So traditional methods can far enhance the quality of nutrition we receive from our foods.
Jennifer McGruther is our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the creator of the website nourishedkitchen.com. And now a book by a very similar name, The Nourished Kitchen, Farm-to-Table Recipes for the Traditional Foods Lifestyle. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about traditional foods, and we'll get into the recipes as we go ahead here on the Exchange. Our phone numbers for conversation, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. This is not, as we have pointed out in one of our billboards, a vegetarian cookbook per se, is it?
No, certainly not. What we find in traditional foods and across the globe, those societies who adhered to their traditional diets all included a very balanced diet, including meat as well as, you know, vegetable foods. So it was a balance of animal foods as well as vegetable foods. And I think that, you know, the essence that comes out of traditional foods for me is that sense of balance. It's inclusive of raw foods and cooked foods, fermented foods, fresh foods, as well as those that have been preserved through traditional means. It's inclusive of fat and carbohydrate and protein, plants, and meat and offal. It's a very well-rounded diet, which can be lacking in many of our more contemporary approaches to healthy food. And I think that what we emphasize, however, is not just the importance of meat in general, but particularly of grass-fed and pasture-raised meats, because they have a different variety of healthy fats that they can offer the body.
Before we get into that, I want to ask about sweeteners, though, because there's a section on that in the introductory chapter. What kinds of sweeteners do you tend to use? I mean, I'm guessing there's very, very little white sugar in here.
Very little white sugar. White sugar is highly refined. Most of the minerals in the sugar cane have been stripped away from white sugar and are found in the molasses. I tend to emphasize honey, raw honey that you can typically find anywhere in the U.S. From local farms. I also use molasses, unrefined cane sugars like jaggery, and I use those in moderation. Jaggery is a traditional Indian sweetener made by boiling down the raw juice of the sugar cane and paddling it until it crystallizes. Sorghum syrup is also a beautiful, beautiful sweetener. It's got a mineral-rich flavor, and it tastes faintly of pineapple. It's a really lovely sweetener. So it's not that I encourage you to avoid all sweets or all celebration foods, because that's what these foods really are. They're foods of celebration. Sweet foods are foods of festivities. But that we choose instead to use the most nutrient-dense of the sweeteners available to us.
All right, the first chapter is on stuff from the garden, and don't scare us. You include weeds in here, but what kinds of weeds?
Oh, yes, purslane is an excellent weed. Purslane, you can also often find it growing in the cracks of sidewalks, and it's got oblong, glossy leaves, and it's got a lemon-like flavor, and it pairs very, very nicely with tomatoes and with cucumbers. Dandelion greens are also, they're popping up all over the place right now in springtime, and they are very, very rich in minerals, and they're rich in a variety of, antioxidants like beta-carotene. So those are some of the weeds that I use pretty readily in my diet, as well as nettle. Stinging nettle, must be handled with care. It's a wild food, and it offers a spinach-like flavor, and like all greens, it's rich in folate, which is a wonderful nutrient.
For the folks who've been thinking about, for example, taking the dandelions out of their lawns by hand and using those for food, what are some of the proper preparation techniques? And I suppose if they've been spraying anything on the lawn, they probably should just not do this, right?
I wouldn't recommend consuming dandelions that have been grown in an area that's been sprayed. So if you don't spray your lawn and your dandelions aren't terribly close to your neighbor's lawn if they spray, avoid sprayed dandelions and weeds, certainly. One of the best ways to prepare dandelions is to sauté it. It pairs very, very nicely with bacon. So if you've got some nice pasture-raised bacon, you can sauté the dandelion greens in a little bit of the bacon fat and top them with mustard seed. That's lovely. There's also a recipe in the cookbook for a dandelion green salad with roasted nectarines, which is very, very nice as well.
Sounds fun, but it begs the question, if you're using things like bacon fat, I mean, are traditional foods also somewhat fattier than things we would choose because we're looking for a lower fat content?
Absolutely. Traditional foods emphasizes fat from healthy sources. For example, in the studies of Dr. Price, what he found all across the world is that the traditional diets of healthy people, and these are people who are free from heart disease and who are free from diabetes and many of our modern ills, their traditional diets hovered around 30% to 80% of fat by calorie. So they were eating, by modern standards, a relatively high-fat diet. Fat is critical. I know that fat has been kind of the bad guy of the health food movement for several decades now, but fat is actually pretty critical to several biological functions. And what's best about fat is that it actually helps us to better absorb the nutrients that our plant foods contain. So, for example, beta-carotene or a lot of the antioxidants that we would consume in our vegetables are made more bioavailable by pairing them with fats.
Interesting. So actually, it's sort of like the key to unlocking a door to let the good stuff into your system.
Certainly.
I want to ask further into the chapter about from the garden. For the folks who are used to buying the bag stuff or buying heads of lettuce from the stores, I mean, how much should a salad change through the seasons?
Salads do change dramatically through the seasons, and there's always a beautiful evolution and rhythm to the way the availability of foods change. For example, in the springtime, that's when we've exhausted our root crops from the wintertime, and all of these young shoots and flowers and little leaves and fresh herbs are coming up. And later in the summertime, we find that robust tomatoes, cucumbers, and other vegetables are replacing those at the farmer's market because lettuces will bolt, of course, during the high heat of summer. And as those foods fade away, come the autumn and winter crops, winter squash, carrots, and other foods. And so salads we often think of as being only lettuce and only leafy greens, but any vegetable can be made into a wonderful, wonderful salad. In fact, there's an autumn salad that I particularly care for, which is of roasted beets and toasted walnuts and a kombucha, which is a fermented tea with a flavor similar to cider vinegar, and olive oil. And that's a lovely salad.
You include dressings with many of the salads in the book. I mean, is there a key in your mind to how to choose the best dressing for a certain salad?
I think that just look at the flavor profiles that you have. There's a pairing, a natural pairing that will come to mind, for example, in the springtime, we have all those bitter greens that come up, and they pair so well with something that is tart and acidic. So buttermilk is very, very nice on bitter greens. Lemon is very, very nice with bitter greens. And later, as the summer progresses, you'll find that those more robust, fruits and vegetables, the tomatoes, etc., benefit from herbs.
These are almost like wine and food pairings, salad and dressing pairings.
Absolutely.
All right. Jennifer McGruther is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her cookbook is The Nourished Kitchen, farm-to-table recipes for the traditional foods lifestyle. She's also the creator of NourishedKitchen.com. You can join our discussion about food and talk about some of the recipes. We'll get further into those as we move ahead on the Jefferson Exchange. Back here with Jennifer and with you in a minute 15. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jennifer McGruther, the creator of the website NourishedKitchen.com. It has become a book now as well, The Nourished Kitchen, farm-to-table recipes for the traditional foods lifestyle. It talks about traditional foods philosophy and the food activism that Jennifer has been involved with for a number of years and includes a bunch of recipes in a bunch of categories. It is not a vegetarian cookbook, but we also talk about animals and their proper care and feeding, particularly feeding on grass. All that in The Nourished Kitchen. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number is 541-552-6782. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We have a message here from a caller wanting to know about foraging for miner's lettuce. Is that something you've heard of, Jennifer?
Certainly. Miner's lettuce is a wonderful green. It's not readily accessible where I live in Colorado. So I wouldn't be able to offer too many foraging tips for that in particular. But in general, for foraging, you want to make sure that you're steering clear of any areas that may be prone to spraying, may be subject to runoff, industrial runoff. And miner's lettuce in general is really nice paired with lemon as well as herbs like chive.
All right. We would talk just a moment ago about preparing dandelion greens with bacon fat, and there's a recipe in here as well for buttered spinach, which sounds great. Tell us more.
Buttered spinach is one of my favorite recipes. In researching this book, I also delved into several old journals that I had come across throughout the years, and the buttered spinach in this book comes from an antebellum journal written by a southern farm wife. And it details how to pick the youngest spinach greens, and she wilts them, or in this recipe that's been adapted more for a modern audience, it's wilted and then paired with butter, salt and pepper, and fresh boiled eggs.
Sounds great. Let's take a call here. We have Mark in Reading on the line. If the button will push, there we go. Mark in Reading, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jennifer McGruther. The Nourished Kitchen is her book.
Good morning. Do you ever use garlic scapes?
Yes. Oh, garlic scapes are wonderful. For people who are unfamiliar with garlic scapes are the shoots or the flowers that will come up in the springtime as farmers plant their garlic. And you cut them off, and that helps to send energy down to the bulb to make those cloves of garlic really big. One of the best ways to prepare garlic scapes is to ferment them or to pickle them as you would pickled cucumbers. There's actually a recipe in the Nourished Kitchen for brine pickled garlic scapes, and they're fermented in a salt water brine. That brine promotes the proliferation of beneficial bacteria, which will then infuse them with a wonderful tart flavor.
Mark, is this something you have used, garlic scapes?
Oh, all the time. I get them in the spring when they're available. They're only on hardneck garlic. If a person's growing softneck garlic, you don't get garlic scapes.
That's right.
All right. Well,
but,
thanks.
I use them mainly for garlic scape pesto, which I use on as a pizza topping rather than spreading it out as a layer of itself. I just take lumps of it and throw it on top of the cheese.
Wow.
It's fabulous.
That sounds good. Thanks for bringing garlic scapes to our attention, Mark. That's a good stuff there. I want to move on to away from the garden and into the pasture, because it is chapter two in the book. And here again, you point out that, as with salads, that if they're in with the rhythm of what's actually growing out there, should change with the seasons. There are seasons to milk and eggs, as you point out.
Yes, there are seasons to milk and eggs. It's easy to forget that when you can go to the grocery store and milk and eggs are perpetually available. But milk and eggs are seasons are prominent in spring and summer, and they start to wane in autumn before often they disappear completely in wintertime, depending on your area. This is because cows or seasonal dairies will often breed the cows in the late summer, early autumn, and then they dry off the cows for the remainder of their pregnancy. And that's best for the cows, and of course it's best for the milk as well. And then in the springtime, when calving season begins, and it begins in the spring because then the young calves don't have to handle a rough and cold winter, they're there when the summer is bright and lovely. And then the cows begin to lactate again. And it's springtime when all of the fresh greens and grasses are available in the pasture. So that springtime milk and cream is incredibly rich. It's very, very rich in fat-soluble vitamins, like vitamins A, D, E, and K2, of course. And it's also rich in antioxidants like beta-carotene, which accounts for cream's yellowish color in the springtime. Same with eggs. Chickens, have a season as well where they begin to lay in the springtime, and that kind of peaks in the around midsummer, and then wanes again and during the dark days. So cream and eggs are highly seasonal foods when farmers are practicing traditional methods of farming, and you find them in their peak in the summertime.
Yeah, there is a section here on raw milk, which tends to be rather controversial. But I guess the larger, more philosophical question for me is about if you can remember the first time you tasted actual milk versus the stuff that we get in the store shelves.
It was a beautiful experience. We got our first raw milk from our local dairy here, and it was light but rich at the same time for me. And it had a freshness that I just couldn't find in pasteurized milk. It's also had faint grassy notes, and that comes from what the cows are eating. So you'll find that the taste of raw milk changes with the seasons, depending on the local flora in the area. I have a funny story. My son was very, very young, and we had been giving him raw milk from our local dairy, and we ran out, and I could only find some pasteurized milk. And he tasted it, he spat it out, and he started to cry. He was only about two at the time. He started to cry and said, "Well, this isn't the milk from nettle."
Uh-huh.
Because he could taste the difference.
Well, that's amazing. At two, you said?
Yeah.
Oh, that is amazing. Making yogurt yourself from milk, what do you need here to be able to do this, and how careful do you have to be to not and I guess this is true for any fermentation process. How careful do you have to be to not poison yourself?
Fermentation is actually one of the safest methods for preparing foods. And so when people consider fermentation, they consider that, you're actually creating an environment where bacteria proliferate. And so that can be a little bit off-putting. But that it's the proliferation of beneficial bacteria, or at least neutral bacteria, and that proliferation of those beneficial bacteria actually eliminates the risk of foodborne illness by potentially pathogenic bacteria. So you do certainly have to be safe. In preparing yogurt, you need yogurt to prepare yogurt. So you have a starter, and you mix it with milk. You can mix it with raw milk, and raw milk yogurt tends to be runny, or you can mix it with milk that you've scalded on the stove, which helps to denature some of the proteins and results in a much thicker yogurt. And you leave it on the countertop for 8 to 24 hours, and then at the end of it, you can strain it off and put it in the fridge, and it will last longer. Remember, fermentation, whether of milk or grain or vegetable, is a method of food preservation.
It seems like from what you write in the book about yogurt that there are lots of varieties from country to country. It seems like it's something that most of the world, the parts of the world that have dairy cows have yogurt.
That's correct. Absolutely. And remember, milk is a seasonal food, so it's understandable that the parts of the world that were dairying parts would offer a wide variety of methods for preserving it, from butter to cheese to yogurt. There is Filia, which is a popular Finnish yogurt. It's mildly sweet, and it's viscous and almost jelly-like in consistency, so it's very well loved by children. There's Filmjölk, which is another Scandinavian variety. It tastes mildly of cheese. It's typically less sour than other yogurts, and it pairs well with herbs and dill and parsley. Pima is similar to Filmjölk in flavor. It's cheese-like, but it lacks that thickness, so it's more like a cultured beverage. And then, of course, we have the popular yogurts that we know in the United States. Most of the yogurts that you find in the dairy case are thermophilic yogurts. That means that they're fermented at a slightly higher temperature of about 108 to 112 degrees Fahrenheit. And those are wonderfully rich as well. But there's a wide variety of yogurts all across the dairying world.
We had mentioned that this is not a vegetarian cookbook, and in fact, Chapter 3 is about From the Range. And it sounds like you personally returned to eating animals after a long vegetarian period under certain conditions. What are those conditions, Jennifer?
I believe that we should practice grass-fed and pasture-raised animals. We should adhere to those methods because they support the animal's health. They support environmental health. Remember, while I advocate for the consumption of meat, I don't advocate for CAFOs or concentrated animal feed operations. There really is this balance between industrialized meat and no meat at all, and that's what I focus on in the Nourished Kitchen. And so holistic plant grazing is a concept that's championed by the Savory Institute out of Boulder, Colorado, and it's a practice in which the farmer strategically rotates the herd from one pasture to the next. And what you find with this system is that not only do the animals produce superb meat because it's high in omega-3 fatty acids, but also it benefits the land as well. And you see with these practices of holistic planned grazing that in some areas of the world they're actually doing a lot of good to reverse desertification. So it's good for the environment, it's good for your body, and it's good for the animals as well.
We've had Joel Salatin on the program a couple times from Polyface Farm in Virginia explaining the process of rotating the animals across the landscape, and it's quite fascinating.
Yes.
But do grass-fed conditions, though, for the animals make for somewhat tough meat, as you point out in the book? And if so, how do you remedy that?
Certainly. When the animals are raised on pasture, they're moving out around a lot more, and they're eating a relatively leaner diet. This means that their meat can be seen as tougher than a lot of the meat that you can find in the grocery store. And so, again, we go back to the traditional methods of food preparation, and that means that we slow roast a lot of these meats. We stew them. It's long, slow, low cooking, and that really infuses not only the meats with remarkable flavor, but it also tenderizes the meat so that they're luscious and succulent and very delicious.
Goose liver mousse shows up in here. This is specifically not pâté, though, right?
It's the type of pâté the mousse is.
Without the force feeding is my point.
What it is not is foie gras, which is, again, like you said, force feeding, where geese are force-fed a large amount of grains. Geese, like all migratory birds, will gorge themselves in preparation for the long flight. And so it's a seasonal dish, fatty goose liver, which is not to be confused with foie gras. Fatty goose liver can be found on, a pasture-raised farm that is raising geese, and it can also be found in wild geese, if you hunt wild geese. And it's rich, but it is certainly a far cry from the large foie gras that you find from gauvage feeding.
And then and then cow's liver, I mean, God, I hated this as a kid. I mean, I had to, like, slice it up so small it was, like, swallowed like pills. I mean, how can you prepare liver for people like me and make it palatable or, if not even somewhat tasty?
Certainly. Liver is probably one of the most hated foods. So you're not alone. But in looking back to traditional methods of cooking liver, what we find is that old-time cookbooks, they refer to clearing liver of blood, and that means that you soak it overnight in milk or in salt water, and that helps to rid liver of a lot of its mineral denseness. So instead it becomes soft and much, much lighter than maybe the liver many of us enjoyed or didn't enjoy as children. And instead, a great way to cook liver is, again, as a mousse, where you pair it with a lot of butter or other foods that help lighten it. Also, after you've soaked the liver, pairing it with bacon is always wonderful. It pairs very nicely with bacon and shallots and onions. And the real key to preparing liver so that it's not unpalatable is the soaking in milk as well as very light cooking. You don't want to overcook it.
In the process of going to traditional foods and letting people know about them, in a sense re-educating us to traditional foods, I mean, you're running across people who once used to cook this way and are feeling vindicated that at last the techniques that they'd been told to stop doing years ago are coming back into favor?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I have a very vocal readership at nourishkitchen.com, and many of our elder readers find quite a bit of vindication in their continued use of butter or their continued use of liver and meat and broth. And what's really interesting is finding that the grandchildren or the great children, people of younger generations, as they re-embrace this, are looking to their grandparents and finding this element of connection when it comes to culinary heritage.
All right, the book is called The Nourished Kitchen. The website, nourishedkitchen.com. The book is out from 10 Speed Press, and Jennifer McGruther wrote it and maintains the website as well. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
A pleasure. Monday on the Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk to the folks at CASA of Jackson County about what the court-appointed special advocate program is all about. We will talk about Ashland taking steps as a city to ban plastic bags, the single-use grocery bags, not just for groceries for that matter. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of The Galapagos, a natural history. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again Monday at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And please have a great weekend.